My name's Matt. It's great to see you. We've been in a series for a few weeks talking about how change and growth in our lives is often slower than we want it to be. And this is true in the areas where we're wanting God to do something. We're praying. We want God to answer, to show up, to do something in our lives. We talked about that waiting a little bit last week. And it's true with the things that we have a say in, areas of our lives where we're trying to change. We're trying to have a new perspective or change a habit or posture or whatever it is. And if you're like me, sometimes we do the thing where we go, well, I read the book and I went to counseling like twice. Hello. And I got up earlier for like 7 days in a row. Nobody else. Like, why isn't my life changing dramatically, instantly, like I was hoping? And as we've been saying, change that lasts is often slow. It's often by like a degree or two at the most at a time. Well, I want to look at something this morning rather unusual that happens to the Apostle Paul in the New Testament. And it's a well-known story. It's the story of Paul's conversion. And it seems to be one of those stories of instant, dramatic, incredibly dramatic change. And I want to explore it because I think there's a lot more going on than we might think. Secondly, it has a lot for us today. And so I was going to tell you to hang with me that we're doing something a little bit different. But I say that like every other Sunday. But seriously, you're going to be wondering two things. Where is this going? Maybe three things. What is this, school? And three, what does this have to do with me? And we'll get there. We'll get to the you. We just got to do some other work up front. So here we go. With that, I also want to mention I'm drawing a bit here from a New Testament scholar named Conrad Genf, and also N.T. Wright's very well-done biography on the Apostle Paul called Paul. And we actually don't know what he looked like. That's one person's guess. If you have a Bible, please turn with me to Acts chapter 9. So, Saul shows up really pretty early on in the life of the early church. There are these followers of Jesus and these people that are going around claiming that Jesus truly was crucified and has risen from the dead. And the key for what we're about to start with is that at first, all of these believers in Jesus are Jewish. Like, they just believe, in addition to being Jewish, that Jesus is the Messiah. And so for that reason, Christianity, they weren't even called Christians at first, but it was not thought of as like a new religion to begin with. It was thought of by, as we'll see, Paul, and everyone else in the first century, as like a sect or a branch or even maybe a heresy, you know, of predominant Judaism. And so because of that, over time, as we'll read, Christians, these followers of the way of Jesus, began to be persecuted. Like, what are you doing? This is not the view that we have on the Messiah or these things. So we pick this up in Acts chapter 9, verse 1. It says, meanwhile, Saul was still breathing out murderous threats against the Lord's disciples, followers of Jesus. He went to the high priest and asked him for letters to the synagogues in Damascus so that if he found any there who belonged to the way, again, they weren't called Christians because this is not a new religion to begin with, who belonged to the way, whether men or women, he might take them as prisoners to Jerusalem. As he neared Damascus on his journey, suddenly a light from heaven flashed around him. He fell to the ground and heard a voice say to him, Saul, Saul, why do you persecute me? So Saul is suddenly knocked from his donkey onto his... He's knocked from his donkey. Verse 5. Who are you, Lord? Saul asked. I am Jesus, whom you are persecuting, he replied. Now get up and go into the city, and you will be told what you must do. The men traveling with Saul stood there speechless, which makes sense. They heard the sound but did not see anyone. Verse 8. Saul got up from the ground, but when he opened his eyes, he could see nothing. So they led him by the hand into Damascus. For 3 days he was blind and did not eat or drink anything. So he has this pretty profound experience, right? Knocked to the ground, he can't see, he hears a voice from heaven, Jesus, and he goes into Damascus, as he is told, and he meets a guy named Ananias. 3 days later, his eyes are opened, he's baptized, and he begins right away in Damascus, in the synagogues, talking about how Jesus is the Messiah. And you can imagine that's confusing for the Jews there, because they probably know about Saul, and they know he might even be coming here to kind of clean up this mess with this heresy. And suddenly, the same Saul shows up and says in the temple, in the synagogue, "Can I have your attention?" Yeah? Jesus is the Messiah. Okay, that's confusing to them. They're like, "Wait, what? What in the world happened to you?" Now, we need to talk for a minute about why the voice didn't call him by the name Paul. That's important. Even more important, we need to talk about why Saul was on the road to Damascus in the first place, because one way or another, he really shouldn't have been there to begin with. Now, the voice called him Saul because that was Paul's name, like one of his names. In Hebrew, the word Saul is Shaul. That's his Hebrew name. Now, chances are, according to a lot of scholars, that Saul would have had one of those, because it's the Roman world as well, he would have had one of those fancy triple Roman names, you know, like Bibulus, Figulus, Flaccus, or whatever. That's floppy-eared, drunk Potter, if your Latin is sharp. But another one of his names would have been, and this is the same thing, it's just a different language, Paul, Paulus, and that's the Greek version. Like when I go to Nicaragua, my name's Matt. Hi. They call me Mateo. Same name, two different languages. So that's what's happening. You've got the Hebrew Shaul, Paulus in Greek. So that's one of Paul's three names, likely. We just don't know what the other two are, okay? But here's an example. A lot of times with these Roman names, like one or two of the names would kind of become prominent and would stand out. So for example, we know two of Gaius Julius Caesar's names. Does that make sense? We call him Julius Caesar. We know one of Marcus Junius Brutus. So that dynamic is going on. But the New Testament does this. It uses multiple names for the same person. Peter is sometimes called Petros. That's the Greco-Roman version of Cephas, which is the same name in Semitic. What is interesting to me is that Saul does not change his name. He doesn't start going by Paulus, at his conversion. He starts using his Roman name much later when he begins going around as the apostle to the Gentiles, to the Romans, which makes sense. What I want to show you is this Damascus Road thing happens in Acts chapter 9, and it's not until midway through Acts chapter 13 that he begins going by Paul. And what we miss is there is a huge time gap and all kinds of things that happen in between that. A couple other background things. Saul was not born in Jerusalem. He was born in a city called Tarsus. And maybe the best way for us to think about it is Tarsus was a pretty well-known, like, university town in the first century. He was born Jewish, but into at the same time, a very, very Roman Gentile world. In fact, according to Acts, he was born a Roman citizen. This all comes into play because later on, Saul will use his Roman citizenship as sort of a trump card when he occasionally needs one. Saul was not simply a secularized nominal Jew. I said in first service that Saul was not an Easter and Christmas Jew. That doesn't make any sense at all. But you get the idea. He's not Jewish. I hope you get the idea. He's not Jewish in name only. In fact, we find out, and this is all from various texts in the New Testament, that Saul was sent away to Jerusalem as a young man for his religious training and education. Apparently, he had relatives in Jerusalem, and it's thought that perhaps he lived with these relatives as he was growing up, being trained kind of on the religious track. But the point is, it's in Jerusalem, and we're going to see this in a minute, that Saul not only succeeded in his education, he actually excelled at the feet of a very important, very impressive Pharisee rabbi named Gamaliel. Now, as far as kind of climbing in the ranks of leadership at this time, I just want to point out it's not a huge problem that he wasn't born in Jerusalem where it's all kind of happening, because the Roman Empire is really big. Jewish people are spread throughout, and various cities are locations of Jewish culture and thought. For example, Alexandria, the great Jewish philosopher Philo came from there. So it's okay that he's not from Jerusalem, and you'll see here in a second. There is extensive evidence from Paul's own letters as well as Acts that Saul was deeply involved in something called Pharisaic Judaism. What that means is that basically Saul is a Pharisee, and Pharisees taught that the most important thing is observing the Torah, that everybody observe all of the law, the Old Testament, without exception. In Galatians 1, verse 14, this is years after his conversion, Paul writes about an earlier time in his life. He says, "I was advancing in Judaism beyond many of my own age among my people and was extremely zealous for the traditions of my fathers." Remember that kid in school that got like all A's all the time? Always doing the extra credit, always raising their hand, pick me, I know the answer, okay? That's Saul. His entire child. He's the teacher's pet. He's an overachiever. He very quickly distinguished himself from a young age in his Jewish studies. So what I want you to be getting is that from an early age, Saul is a guy who's going places. Like he's got potential. He's bright. The other thing that we need to know about him at this point, and this is something that a lot of times we miss as Christians, is that Saul, even after, not before, after his conversion, he still considered himself a Pharisee. Yeah, it's kind of like, what? I thought those were the bad guys. Did you not think that? So it's part of his identity. It's part of his training. And you see, it's not just with Saul. There are other believers, like Acts casually mentions. Then some of the believers who belong to the party of the Pharisees. So you could be a Pharisee and be a follower of Jesus at this point. In Philippians chapter 3, Paul says, talking about himself, "If someone else thinks they have reasons to put confidence in the flesh, I have more." Notice he doesn't say, "I had more," past life. No, "I have," present tense. And then he gives some reasons why he's like a top shelf, his pedigree is way up there. Circumcised on the eighth day, of the people of Israel, the tribe of Benjamin, a Hebrew of Hebrews, in regard to the law, a Pharisee. Which means Saul is not completely abandoning his old religion for like a brand new thing. I mean, even during his ministry, he doesn't write off Judaism in the way that maybe sometimes we think. Now that raises the question, why does he go on in the very next verse to talk, and it sounds to us pretty negatively, it sounds like, about Judaism. So what's going on? He says, "But whatever were gains to me, I now consider loss for the sake of Christ. What is more, I consider everything a loss because of the surpassing worth of knowing Christ Jesus my Lord, for whose sake I have lost all things. I consider them garbage that I may gain Christ." What is the garbage he's talking about here? What's the loss? Well, Paul gives a speech in Acts that gives a kind of clues about how he saw himself. In Acts 22, he says, "I was a Jew." Anybody? No, "I am a Jew," present tense, right? And he talks about being brought up in the city of Jerusalem. And then he continues and he says, "And I studied under Gamaliel and was thoroughly trained in the law of our ancestors. I was just as zealous for God as any of you are today." What I want you to be hearing is that Paul considers himself a Jew right up into the present moment. It's actually, and this is a very important distinction, it's actually Paul's accomplishments that he considers as garbage. Not Judaism itself. He views his achievements as rubbish in comparison to Jesus. And so he's not saying, hey guys, now that I know the truth, I'm able to see that my past accomplishments were worthless. He's saying, in light of knowing Jesus, compared to the highest heights possible now, the old paradigm seems like rubbish, like garbage in comparison. It's kind of hard for us to hear. What I'm trying to say is he's not switching the old for the new completely. He's not just replacing one with the other. It's not like, to give a science example, sort of, it's not like Paul was like an expert in astrology, you know, like the horoscope and the signs thing. And then at some point he wakes up and goes, wait a second, that doesn't do anything. And he like leaves it all behind because he says it's worthless now that I know the truth. That's not how Paul looks at Judaism. It's more like he looks at Judaism like, he's into Newtonian physics, and then at some point he discovers Einstein and quantum physics. The Newtonian thing, it's not bad, it's not wrong. The only way it's wrong is if you say it's the only thing that there is. I lost you again. What I'm trying to say, let me read my notes. What I'm trying to say, and this is the point if you heard nothing else, what Saul gave up to become a Christian was not Judaism. What he gave up was his career. He let go of a very promising, kind of fast, quickly rising career. And as we're about to see, he does this at a moment when he was about to pull off the biggest career move of his entire life. He was about to put into motion a political maneuver that would have locked him in forever as a renowned Jewish leader for all time. So going back to where we started, my question to you is why? Why was he on that road that day to Damascus? And the simple answer, if you're reading the text, is he was on his way to persecute Christians. But hang on a second. Why him? Why was Saul doing that? Is that part of his job as a Pharisee? Is Saul a member of the temple guard? No. What I'm saying is they had people whose job it was to enforce Jewish law, to enforce religious law. Saul was not one of those people. So was he like some kind of Pharisee, like a fixer? You know what that is? I don't know how to explain it. What's going on? Why is he doing this? And you begin to get a sense, and just hang with me, when he talks about these days later in his life, he kind of slips into a way of talking about it, like the way only like a young person can who's reminiscing a little bit about their recent past. He says, remember in Galatians, I was advancing in Judaism beyond many of my own age. We're also told that Saul was present at the stoning of Stephen, the first Christian martyr, and that Saul was there and he was a young man at the time of that event, watching it. In his speech later in the book of Acts, Paul defines his pre-Christian days according to where he lived and who he studied under. I studied under Gamaliel. Paul was an advanced student. His mentor was the very, very famous Gamaliel. So famous, he's still revered in Judaism to this day. The Jewish Mishnah, which is written centuries after this, it says this: since Rabban Gamaliel, the elder, died, there has been no more reverence for the law, and purity and abstinence died out at the same time. You need to know that Saul's mentor was like the most famous rabbi of the generation, and that Saul was the A student. Saul was the up-and-coming protege of Gamaliel. By the way, this is still 40 years before Rome would come in and sack Jerusalem and destroy the temple and change Judaism forever. On the one hand, you have Paul as an A-plus student, the up-and-coming protege of the most famous rabbi, Gamaliel, of his day. On the other hand, Saul is also a Roman citizen. He has mastered, and this is uncontested, classical Greek. He is well-versed in ancient Greco-Roman persuasion, philosophy, and rhetoric. He's like the perfect hybrid. He's harnessed both worlds at a really important time in these cultures. What would have happened if the rising star Saul had succeeded his mentor, like he was supposed to, and basically taken his place at the ruling council called the Sanhedrin? That is the top of the food chain. That is very likely where Saul was headed. He would have had all kinds of power, all kinds of influence. And when we meet Saul in Acts, he's a young man. He doesn't quite have the credentials yet, does he? Because we see this. Saul's breathing out murderous threats. The second sentence, he went to the high priest and asked him for letters. And this is a clue about Saul's status. He needs a letter of recommendation to do what he wants to do because it's outside of his job description as a Pharisee. The other big clue, though, is he's got enough influence and clout to be able to get it. He is thought well of enough. He's regarded highly enough that he gets the green light. And here's what I want you to hear so far, and I hope this picture is starting to become clear. Saul is a young man with a future. His outlook is promising. Everyone around him, even the high ups, see all of this potential in him. That means that it wasn't like Saul came from obscurity. Sometimes we read it like Saul comes out of nowhere and he becomes a Christian so that he can be like a big fish in a small pond. That's kind of how it feels, right? No, not at all. He was already a very big fish in an extremely large pond. His teachings, and again, the reputation of Gamaliel, his mentor, stretch into today. All of that means this. It's possible that the words of Saul of Tarsus could have been immortalized for all time on the path that he was already on. That Orthodox Jews today, had that event not happened, that there's a reasonable chance that Orthodox Jewish people today would be talking about Saul of Tarsus the same way they talk about Gamaliel the Wise or Hillel or Akiva or any other number of legendary Jewish leaders. That's the setup. You ready for the tension? Because we're getting into it now. When your mentor, put yourself in his place, when your mentor stands as tall in the spotlight as Gamaliel stood, how do you, as a young person, get out from underneath their shadow? I'll tell you, when the time is right and your education is done, you got to figure out how to make a name for yourself. Like in our day, that means you got to publish a paper, you got to, you know, add to the prevailing research or disagree and add something to it. Or in a different field, you've got to initiate some daring market. I don't do this stuff, right? Take over a startup. You've got to do something to distinguish yourself, like that your mentors maybe didn't see coming, or that you took the ball forward in a dramatic way. This, I think, explains why Saul of Tarsus was on the road that day to persecute Christians. This is like I don't expect anybody to know this, but just in case somebody does, you'll get a lot of bonus points. What was Saul's mentor, remember Gamaliel? What was his mentor's take on these Jesus people? This sect of Judaism called the Way. What did Gamaliel think? What was his stance on these Christians? Does anybody know? One person knew it in first service. Gamaliel's stance, it's in the Bible, was this. Basically, he stands up. Gamaliel says to the Sanhedrin, again, the top of the pyramid, right? He says to the Sanhedrin, hey, guys, this has happened before, that one time this guy named Theudas appeared and there was a big movement. And when they killed him, all the followers disappeared. Oh, there was another guy named Judas the Galilean. Same thing. He died. All his followers, it amounted to nothing. Then Gamaliel says this to the Sanhedrin. Therefore, in the present case with these Christians and that they're wanting to put to death, leave these men alone. Let them go. For if their purpose or activity is of human origin, it will fail. But if it is from God, you will not be able to stop these men. you will only find yourselves fighting against God. So Gamaliel's stance is, let him go. No persecution, no hassle, no fuss. It'll fizzle out on its own, just like every other movement that we've seen. And then Gamaliel, the next line in Acts, Luke says, Gamaliel's speech persuaded them. That's Bible speak for they all sat down and shut up. End of discussion. Argument over. So everyone calmed down, and this is important, but only for a little bit. This is Acts 5. The Sanhedrin starts to get worked up again. The lid comes off again. The anger, the outrage once again grows, and it reaches a boiling point. Two chapters later, Acts chapter 7, the murder, the stoning of the first Christian, Stephen. And who is presiding over that? The Sanhedrin, right? They ruled against him. In Acts chapter 7, where's Saul in all of that? He's not a part of the Sanhedrin. He's there holding their coats. Kind of a minor role at this point. What's he doing? What's he thinking? Obviously, we don't know for sure, but perhaps Saul saw in this moment an opportunity to distinguish himself from his mentor. Aha. I can take a different path. I can, with one move, become more active in all of this. And Gamaliel, that's not his stance, but I can do something that will be immediately incredibly popular with the people. I can take charge of handling these Christians, this dangerous new heresy. He could distinguish himself from his master in one brilliant move. And so you see him taking a minor part. Right after this, Paul goes, I think I'm going to take a little more active role. I think I'm going to engage this a little bit more. And you see, the beginning of chapter 8, the very next part, Saul approved of their killing of Stephen. Persecution breaks out. And then look at verse 2. Godly men buried Stephen. Verse 3, but Saul began to destroy the church. Going from house to house, he dragged off both men and women and put them in prison. And then you know what the next chapter is? Saul is leading the expedition to Damascus. You see how he's amped this up? And again, he doesn't have the authority to do this. He's not a temple guard, but he's well enough connected to get it. Do you know what Saul does? We read that and we go, oh, that's neat. He went to the high priest. Saul is a Pharisee. He doesn't go to Gamaliel, because what's Gamaliel going to say? No, don't do that. That's a bad strategy. I don't endorse that. He doesn't go to any member of the Pharisaic party. Saul, because he's thinking and his wheels are turning, he goes across the political aisle. He goes to the enemy party of the Pharisees, which is the Sadducees. Do you know who sits in the position of power at the very top of the Sadducees pyramid? The high priest. Saul crosses these party lines. He goes to the high priest. He gets the letter. And we should be thinking, wait a second. This guy really has some... You can't just walk into the high priest's office and get that kind of permission, that kind of blessing. Saul of Tarsus is on the rise. He's making his move. He's transitioning from like promising grad student to like, whoa, this guy's got some ambition. He's a leader in his own right. And by the way, I'm not saying that Paul was just taking advantage of the political. There's that. But there's also the bigger thing of like, the central belief in Judaism is the oneness of God. And the way these early Christians talk about Jesus, the way they, oh my goodness, worship him, that would generate the kind of outrage that you would save not for your enemy, but for a traitor. So that's the emotion. I mean, Saul would have hated Christianity. And so he rose up from a minor role to a major one. And it just so happened to be at a time that would serve his career really, really well. If it weren't for one tiny thing that happens that's really annoying, that gets in his way. Saul fully expected to go on this little mission, mop up this group of heresy people, you know, these heretics, come back to Jerusalem. Yay, Saul, he's our hero. He ended that whole thing. That's so great. And on the way, before he could get there, he was intercepted. A bright light knocked him over, and a voice came calling his name. "Who are you, Lord?" Saul asked. "I am Jesus, whom you are persecuting," he replied. Later in Acts, Paul is retelling this story, and he adds an interesting detail. He says, this is Saul's words, that was Luke's words. He says, I heard a voice saying to me in Aramaic, "Saul, Saul, why do you persecute me? It is hard for you to kick against the goads." Does anyone know what a goad is? I know. I feel like I should know that. It's not a word that we use unless you're like, you have animals or you're a farmer. It's a like a sharpened, sturdy stick that you would use to prod livestock, right? The cattle, the cow has thick hide, and you can't just like tap them and get their attention. So you got to kind of get in there, right? And then they can't ignore that. And God, Jesus, says to Saul, "I'm trying to get your attention, and you've been resisting, and I just want you to know, Saul, it's pointless. You can go arrest followers of Jesus, you can put them in jail, you can kill them, you can persecute them, but in the end, Saul, I'm going to win. It's pointless to resist all of this." And you have this very zealous Pharisee who was infuriated by all this Jesus stuff, who's trying to kickstart his career, and he's got a window of opportunity, and he has to learn that the future lay not in fighting against Jesus, but going where God's telling him to go. What we do know for sure is that Paul, never became a leading Jewish rabbi in his day. He never became the president of the Sanhedrin, like his master Gamaliel was thought to have been. He didn't even get a comfortable apartment in the temple quarters in Jerusalem. He gave all of that up. Can you imagine that? Leaving the whole field when your prospects for promotion are really high. Talk about burning your bridges. Remember how he could just walk into the high priest and get what he wanted? Get the paperwork? He's never going to see the high priest again unless the high priest is like stoning him as a result of this very dramatic move. So first question this raises is, what would cause a person to do this? I mean, what would have to happen for you to make that kind of change in your life? I mean, for Saul to go overnight, he steps onto the pages of history overnight as the person who, yesterday, I was hunting down Christians, trying to eradicate them from the earth. Today, whole new perspective. What do you think would have to happen? Well, it raises the possibility that what Acts describes is perhaps the most plausible explanation, that he actually met Jesus on the road to Damascus. And in that moment, it changed everything. What does all of this mean for you, for me? I'm glad you asked. First of all, I think it means that God is fully capable of getting our attention when he wants to. Would you agree? It's hard for you, Saul, to kick against the goads. He's doing everything literally in his power to stop this, to go in the opposite direction. And Jesus says, "How long will you resist?" You know, that's really good news for stubborn people like me, who have to hear things like 10,000 times and have to learn things the hard way for it to finally click. Boy, wouldn't it be interesting if God was trying to get your attention and was fully capable of doing that? That actually is not our, we don't have to worry about that part. And by the way, I'm talking about you, not the stubborn person next to you. Okay? God is really good at getting our attention through our circumstances, sometimes through pain, frustration, sometimes through other people, any number of things. How many of you have had that experience where you're like driving to Target and then you see a bright light and then suddenly you can't see or hear and you hear a voice from heaven and you're stunned? None of you? Okay. That the fact that that hasn't happened to you, I don't want to speculate, but I think one of the possibilities is that God was trying to get Saul's attention like 100 times before this. And Saul kept on like going the opposite direction until finally God on the 100th time is like, boom. And Saul got knocked off his high horse, right? Maybe it's a good thing that that hasn't happened to you or me yet. That God uses other things that hopefully we can learn earlier rather than the hard way later. One of the things, the obvious things this meant for Saul is that Saul, in order to change, had to give something up. What did he give up? His whole future. His entire career, success, status, accolades, recognition, maybe stuff with his family. Who knows what they thought about this change in his life. At some point, I want everybody to hear this, following Jesus, going where he's calling you to go, at some point, it is going to cost each one of us. And I don't know what that cost is going to be. He may not ask you to give up like your career, right? But at some point, and not every day, not all the time, it will cost us something. And don't worry, you're going to know. Am I doing it now? It's obvious because it's like my reputation or success or something. Here's the good news. The trade-off is worth it. What does Paul later say? You know all those things I had going for me? It's not that they were bad in and of themselves. It's just that in comparison to what I have now, I don't miss it at all. It's garbage. It's rubbish. All that compared to what I have in Jesus now. And then last thing, it is true. And I know this is what we want. For change to happen, boom, like that, and for it to be instant and dramatic. And the good news is lightning can strike, and we can have epiphanies in the moment, and we can have very clear, I was doing this, and there's like God showed up, and my life was forever changed in an instant. God can and does do that sometimes. It's just rare. Emily Dickinson, she says in one of her poems, and I don't know if she's thinking about Paul or not, but I am with this. She says, the truth must dazzle gradually, or every man be blind. I've thought about that now for about a year, and I think that's very true. We want instant change, and in fact, what we experience is day after day, week after week, month after month, of little incremental, hopefully, growth that perhaps we don't even notice in the moment. I have come to see it as a gift. That God, in his grace, allows this to happen slowly. Because you know what? If it happened all at once, it would be pretty painful. It would be more than like I could take. And so thank God that he allows this to develop for most of us over time. That it's not dramatic, because dramatic would mean I can't even see. Because it's so bright. It raises the question, so what about with Saul? Because it seemed like it was pretty instant, right? Pretty dramatic. He was literally blinded by the light. He goes on, and he mentions this later in Galatians. He says this in verse 1, chapter 1, verse 8, 17 and 18. He says, after this experience, he says, I went to Arabia. He mentions he goes back to Damascus. And then after 3 years, I went up to Jerusalem. After this encounter, Saul, Paul, goes to Arabia. Do you know what's in Arabia? Sand. The desert. Wilderness. And somewhere between Arabia and Damascus, he spends 3 years just preparing. And then he goes to Jerusalem, and it goes on. Do you know how long he was in Jerusalem? 15 days. 15 days, and then he goes back to Tarsus, his hometown, remember? From roughly 36 AD to 46 AD, CE, Common Era, whatever, for 10 years, Saul is in Tarsus. And that's the piece that we miss. Before he's planted any churches, before he's taken any amazing missionary journeys, before he's written a single famous letter, he spends 10 years in his hometown trying to convince Aunt Becky or whoever that this stuff is true. He spends that time, nobody knows who he is. He's not a prominent person, and he doesn't have a reputation. He's given all that up. His poor parents are like, what are you doing with your life? He's making tents, right? N.T. Wright says about this time, Saul spent a decade deepening the well of scriptural reflection from which he would thereafter draw the water he needed. So you add that 10 years to the 3 years in Arabia and Damascus, you got 13 years before he's done a single thing that he is now remembered for. And that's the Apostle Paul, the A-plus student, the teacher's pet, the guy, the rising star, had to forget everything that he knew and be willing to unlearn all of that or to relearn it or somehow put it, to look at it differently. Can you imagine the humility that that would take? To go, I'm going back to the beginning. Wow. I guess what that might mean, final thought, is if you're waiting for something to change, you're waiting for some movement, you're waiting for something to happen, and you're like, God, why are you taking so long? Why isn't this happening quicker? Why aren't I seeing the dramatic transformation in my life today that I want? Perhaps God is trying to prepare you for the next thing. I want that time to be like 4 days. If the Apostle Paul had to wait 13 years, right? What might that mean for you and me? The other thing that I like about this picture is that whole time when he's hanging out at home, some of you are like, well, this is really close to home. That whole time that he's hanging out at home, he could have said to God, and I don't know, maybe he got frustrated like, God, there are churches to plant. There are missionary journeys to take. There's a whole world out there that needs to know about Jesus. Come on, why is this taking so long? And God, for whatever reason, essentially says to Paul, I know all that, but I'm trying to do something in you to prepare you for what I want to do through you later on. So I'm just guessing that there are some of us here in that season. And I want you to hear me say, you're not being punished. You're not forgotten. But I'm in the desert. The desert, by the way, is cool because that's like, you got a good story. The 10 years in Tarsus, that's not cool. Maybe you're there. And you're not even going to have a good story. But God is doing something in you to prepare you for what he wants to do through you. Next month, next year, 10 years from now. If we'll trust that process. Would you stand? We'll pray. Heavenly Father, we just, Lord, I pause to thank you that you see each one of our stories, each one of our circumstances, each one of our frustrations, every area of our lives where we are waiting for a door to please crack open. And that God, you are with us in this moment. Thank you for the reminder from Scripture, from the life of Paul, that even when we're in a time of preparation, that's not because you've forgotten us. It's not because you're punishing us. It might actually be because you want to use us in a way later, but you've got to do something in us. There are things that we have to unlearn. There are things that we have to hear first. So help us to do that. Give us ears to hear what you want to say to us. May we be encouraged. May we find strength even in the season of waiting, perhaps, that we're in right now. And just help all of us to be open to what you are calling us to give up. That cost that comes from following you where you're leading us. And give us the strength when that time comes to take that step, to open our hands, and to follow you with courage and boldness in that. It's in Jesus' name we pray. Amen. Well, thanks everyone for being here. Have a great week, and we'll see you next week.